special work on the piano there at the end of that recording. That was a song, My Deliverer, written by Rich Mullins. I think it was about 1995, just before he was killed in an automobile accident. He never recorded it, never got to see the song finished, but his friend Rick Elias and the band called the Ragamuffins got together, recorded this arrangement, and at the very end, Rich Mullins is actually playing the piano. He had sat down to kind of run through the tune in his head at a piano in a church there, and recorded it, put on a cassette. And so they worked that into the end of the recording. Just a really nice touch and a nice piece of work from Rich Mullins and Rick Elias from the Ragamuffins, My Deliverer. It's 11 minutes after the hour now. We're joined by Dr. Don Clark, who is a biochemist and a member of the Board of Creation Moments and a good friend of the station. In fact, he's the only biochemist we have on staff here. And he lives down in Garden Valley, Texas, just east of Dallas by a hoot and a holler. You don't have hoots and hollers down there, do you?
No, we don't have that just slang.
That'd,
nope,
be, a, that'd nope. be a fur piece, probably, though.
It's a fur piece.
Yeah, from Dallas.
Yeah, about 90 miles or so.
Okay, well, I'm looking at a shot that probably has little resemblance to where you live. This is a shot of Washington State. And is looking at the base of Mount St. Helens here. What a gorgeous part of the country this is. I got to fly over it, and I'm trying to remember when. It would have been probably about 1981, I'm thinking. I was on my way up to Seattle from the Los Angeles area. And the pilot took a little detour to take us over Mount St. Helens, which at that time was still billowing some smoke. And we could see the top of the mountain had blown off and all the destruction and damage around it. And it was a pretty awesome sight. That's the only volcano I've ever had a chance to see. And it was especially awesome seeing it from the air. And so I've got some very distinct memories of Mount St. Helens. This picture now, taken recently, doesn't look anything like this. Didn't look anything like what I saw from the air. This is gorgeous. We're talking really about an article here at the Institute for Creation Research. And this is important because Mount St. Helens is kind of a case study. It was an opportunity for modern geologists and naturalists, and I don't know what other kind of scientists would be involved in this, volcanologists maybe, to take a look at what damage a volcano can do. And I remember some dire predictions that it would take generations for this area to ever bounce back again. What's the true story of Mount St. Helens, Don?
Mount St. Helens is a as you said, I mean, it's kind of a microcosm of cataclysmic events, because the volcano originally erupted, of course, in 1980. That was the first massive eruption of the volcano. There was a lava and obviously volcanic rock that was building up under the dome of the mountain, and it eventually burst forth in a giant explosion, which wound up laying down debris north of the north of the mountain.
And as I recall, this was not a surprise either, because scientists have been watching it. I guess volcanoes often give off lots of tremors and shakes and hints that things are about to happen. So they were looking at it, weren't they?
They were looking at it. They were measuring the bulge, and they were wondering, you know, it looked like the volcano was going to erupt, exactly when. Of course, they didn't know. But it looked like it was fairly imminent, and they actually sent out warnings to people who lived in the area that, hey, you better get out because this thing might blow any time. And it finally did in May 18th, 1980. Spewed volcanic dust, for hundreds and hundreds of miles. North of the volcano, it laid down actually 300 feet of volcanic dust.
That is a layer 300 feet thick.
300 feet thick, yes, of dust. And you would think, okay, well, this, as you said, this is going to take a long time to recover. And, wildlife had left the area, and I'm sure some of it got trapped in the dust. But It didn't take that long, actually, to recover. And there was actually another mini eruption that happened 2 years later. I think it was also in the month of May. But by that time, the 300-foot layer of dust and mud, because there was mudslides that happened at the same time of the original eruption, small lake had already formed at the base of the volcano, north of the volcano, and when the second eruption occurred, there was of course snow and ice up at the top. It melted all of that, and then it went rushing down the mountain, you had this water, and that then mixed with the water down at the base of the mountain, and you had this mud flow that came rushing down the mountain. Well, it wound up carving a canyon in the base of the mountain, and in this northern valley. About at least 150 feet deep, and my recollection is it was about 160 feet deep, in a matter of hours, not days, not years, not eons of time, but in a matter of hours, as this mud flow rushed through the canyon there, and rushed through the valley, so. That gave a kind of a different picture as to, hey, you know, how long does it take canyons to form? And in this case, it was short. I mean, not only short, it was like within hours, like I said.
Well, the now, canyon would have been cut in hours, but I understand within 2 years that mud had compressed into distinct layers of rock, which would be reminiscent, I don't know about the color, but reminiscent of areas of the Grand Canyon.
Well, that's exactly right, and the reason for the layers is even interesting, because a lot of study has been done, especially by the folks at the Institute of Creation Research, Stephen Austin in particular, who's a geologist and who spent many, many years studying the results of the catastrophe that happened at Mount St. Helens. But the reason for the layers, and the layers didn't form, like I said, over eons of time, the layers formed very, very quickly because it was a result of mud flows. And when you have fast-moving mud, it actually starts striating into various densities of materials that make up the mud. So what you wind up with is multiple layers being laid down pretty much all at the same time. And when the second eruption occurred, it cut through all of that. And by that time, the dust and the layers of mud had then turned to rock. So you had sedimentary rock formed within 2 years. And again, that didn't take, you know, eons of time. It didn't take thousands of years. It formed, you know, within 2 years. It was solid rock. And so when the second mud flow came, it cut through the sedimentary rock, and it cut, it had so much force that not only did it form this canyon, as I said, fairly deep, but it also cut into base rock that was underneath the initial sedimentary rock. So it had tremendous force. And it caused tremendous, you know, not destruction, but this canyon to be formed. Now, you would think that the geologists that would be in this area and are talking about it and taking people on tours would have the information correct as to how the canyon formed. But when a local geologist who was taking a group on tour was asked, how did this canyon form? When did it form? He said it took, decades of time for the canyon to form. Well, mm-hmm. It didn't take decades of time. It took 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So it was, even in the light of the evidence that was there, and if you did your studies correctly, you would know that catastrophes such as this can change the geological features, you know, of the Earth very, very rapidly. Now, there's some other things that happened at Mount St. Helens that, you know, we should be interested in. It is you know, kind of a microcosm of what we see here in the United States, not only for the Grand Canyon, but Bryce Canyon and areas of petrified forest, for example. So what happened when the first and the second volcano, the second time it erupted and the first time that it erupted, it stripped the north side of the of Mount St. Helens, the mountain, clean of trees that had grown on that side, of course, over time, and it deposited it in a lake called Mira Lake. So these trees, I mean, thousands of trees, thousands and thousands of these huge trees, you know, got swept away, and a lot of them landed or wound up in Mira Lake down at the bottom of the mountain, bottom of the volcano. And of course, the trees were horizontal at the time, and they floated for, you know, a period of time. But as they began to get waterlogged, you would think, well, you know, what happens to a tree when it gets waterlogged? Well, it's going to sink. Well, these sank, but they didn't sink horizontally. They actually wound up sinking vertically. So now you had these trees vertical in different layers of mud at the bottom of the lake. Well, of course, you know, the mud that was deposited in the lake came from the same mud flows that created the sedimentary rock, you know, in the basin. And so what you had was trees in different layers that looked like they were, you know, deposited there over eons of time, but again, they, you know, within a couple of years, they were sinking and being, you know, deposited, as if you had a petrified forest being formed. And, you know, slowly over time, and it wasn't that slow, within 10 years, these trees started to petrify. So it gives us a clue as to, well, how do you form a petrified forest? Well, you need water, for one. You need water with a lot of minerals in it, which, of course, a volcanic explosion is going to give you. And the trees have to be in the water for a period of time, and then they have to settle. And now, the reason for why the trees settled to the bottom horizontally vertically instead of horizontally is because the base of the tree is heavier than the top of the tree. And so when the base of the tree, you know, gets waterlogged and the whole tree is getting waterlogged, of course, it's heavier at the base. And so the natural tendency is for us it to sink in a vertical position as if it was, you know, had grown there for a period of time. So you get this, you know, this petrification going on, which absolutely requires water to be there. And so when you go visit, you know, the petrified forests in various, you know, places in the United States, Yosemite has petrified forests, and of course other you know, parts of Utah and various other places have petrified forests. You can look and say, wow, there is definitely evidence here of a global flood, instead of saying, well, that happened over millions and millions of years, and you can see by these, you know, various trees being in the various layers that obviously this forest had been here, you know, for a long period of time. Well, that's not the case.
Well, based upon the Mount St. Helens experience, what are scientists concluding now? Are they revising their whole idea of geologic time?
No.
No?
Not the classic. Not the...
No.
Well, of course, you know, the creation scientists who are geologists, you know, point to this and say, hey, folks, wake up. This is, we've got evidence of this, you know, all around the world. Evidence of as to how, you know, quick-moving water, in this case mud, can cause these striations that we see in the Grand Canyon and other places around the world. The deposits, the thousands of feet of deposits that are seen, you know, on our continent as well as over in Europe, and you know, basically around the world, which are a direct result of you know, major water movement, and not a deposits that take place over time. That's the interpretation that one should get out of Mount St. Helens, and it if you go to Mount St. Helens and then you go to the Grand Canyon, it's like, wow, you know, this is the same process that has taken place, and it's just that the Grand Canyon, it happened over, I mean, you know, just like in Mount St. Helens, it was a couple of stages that created the canyon. The Grand Canyon, it was a couple of stages as well, and we've got evidence of that as to, you can look at the deposits and look at you know, various dams that must have formed during different periods post-flood. And you know, those dams broke and created another mud flow, which then created, you know, more of the canyon that we see. And you know, we can go there and say, okay, well, here this happened. Yes, it happened over the period of time, but not in the time frame that most traditional geologists have been taught.
Is there a scientific apparatus or process or machine that can date the walls of the Grand Canyon or whatever it would take to determine when it formed and over how long a time it formed? I mean, how do they say, well, this has been around since 65 million years? I mean, what leads them to say that, to settle on that number?
Well, it's radioisotopic dating is the primary tool that's used. Now, this dating technique was used on some of the lava flow, the lava rock, the decasite that formed during the lava flow at Mount St. Helens. And the folks at, again, Institute of Creation Research, took some of the decasite and said, let's just see how old these rocks are based on radioisotope dating. So they did potassium-argon isotope. They sent it out to laboratories that do this type of dating. They didn't do it themselves. And they came back with ages between 340,000 to 2.8 million years old for 10-year-old rock. So that would give you some indication as to the accuracy of that particular technique for dating rock. Similarly, you can take rock from the Grand Canyon and rock that you knew formed you know, relatively young, it comes back over 500, you know, 1,000 years old. So the ratio of, you know, potassium and argon radioactivity is not accurate as a way of dating the earth and dating rocks and trying to get a picture as to when that particular event occurred. So, if you don't have that type of technique that you can rely on, what do you rely on as far as the age of something? And now, since the fossils are dated by the type of rock that they're in, and the rock is dated by this isotopic method, and we've you know, I just described how the isotopic method is not accurate for the date of the rock that, you know, has been formed, then your whole dating method for evolution is completely off and completely wrong, because it's based on something that just doesn't work geologically.
So they can't do a test on a fossil itself, but they judge the age of it based upon the layer of the rock that's around it.
That's correct. And, you know, fossils we normally think is mineralized, you know, bones of, you know, some animal that, or some leaf or something that has been, you know, trapped again in mud layers, which have been solidified, again, evidence of the flood. So even the best that you can do is find fossils that aren't mineralized, that is bone. Mm-hmm. And then try to use carbon-14 as your dating method to see, you know, how old that particular bone might be based on the amount of carbon-14.
Now, that's a method that would be used on much younger material, because that doesn't go back tens of thousands of years, does it?
No, I mean, it's... assuming you know that there that you can understand the how much radioactive C-14 was in the atmosphere at the time the animal died, that's how that is based. Mm-hmm. It would go back you know 10 half lives of carbon-14, which is about 50,000 years. Even doing that, you get the wrong number. Because these, as we talked about previously.
Yeah, I was hoping we would get here in this discussion too, because the dating methods to me are of paramount significance here, especially if there's been some scientific research, some testing of these things that say, no, this is baloney. This is not accurate.
Well, it should certainly, you know, raise an eyebrow and say, well, maybe we shouldn't be using that, or maybe we should be looking at some other type of evidence. But, you know, when you start off with a technique and you can use different isotopes. You don't have to use potassium argon or whatever. There are different isotopes that are used, but every time you use these things, you get, when you know how old the rock is, for example, you get the wrong number. And you know, as you say, that should give you some clue as to maybe I can't rely on this particular technique. But they continue to do that and continue to date fossils based on the age of the rock. And the age of the rock, of course, is dated based on these radioisotopic techniques.
And those techniques are built on assumptions, aren't they?
They are built on assumption. They're built that, hey, we you know, had more of this particular radioisotope at the beginning than we do, you know, now. And so depending on how much that has depleted or gone to its child isotope, in this case you know, potassium going to argon, or you know, it you have to make the assumption that it was all potassium, radioactive potassium at the time. And based on the amount of argon that is there, then you can, you know, possibly get an age. But if your original assumption is incorrect, that is, you know, there is more argon there in the beginning, or more daughter isotope there at the very beginning than you think, then it throws your whole dating method, you know, out the window. And that is indeed, you know, what we find over and over again with these dating techniques, that it's just not accurate. Now, remember, the dating technique is used to date the Earth, you know, at 4.8 billion years old, or millions of years old. And so if the dating technique is off, then we can't say anything about the age of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
unless we've got some extra, you know, some examples as to, well, how old might the Earth be? And of course, you know, the ages in the Bible give us a estimate as to how old the creation is, and therefore how old the Earth is.
Okay. And you would think that the labs then that came up with those obviously errant findings about the rock from Mount St. Helens would have done some quick homework, or retrenched a little bit, or at least felt embarrassed. But there's great pressure to find ages of samples that correlate with other findings to maintain their validity, isn't there? I mean, there's money involved. There's, you know, corporate interests. There's you don't want to be controversial in your findings.
Well, there is tremendous pressure to keep the old philosophy going, and to keep the old dogma going. And so a laboratory, for example, that are doing these measurements, I mean, they're just doing the measurements. They're just saying, okay, you know, here's how much potassium you have, and here's how much argon you have, and based on that, the age of this rock is so-and-so. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just using, in quote, standardized techniques. And so you can't blame necessarily the laboratory that's actually doing the measurement, but you can blame the philosophy or the thinking that has gone into
those underlying assumptions have to be questioned.
Yes, exactly. And in that case, you're looking at years and years of this type of thinking and research being kind of thrown out the window. And as we've talked about before on this program, it's very difficult for scientists to say, hey, maybe all of this is wrong. Because it takes someone, you first have to be humble in order to say, hey, I was wrong. And my first thinking on this, those assumptions obviously are not correct. Let's look for another reason, or let's look for another explanation for the results that we're getting. Or let's look at another explanation as to, hey, how can... can we say anything about, you know, the age of these rocks? Maybe we have to correct our numbers, and let's look for a correction factor. I mean, as you know, science is full of correction factors.
Being revised all the time. That's the nature of the process, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And so if you're honest with yourself, and if you're honest with your fellow, you know, scientist, you would say, well, okay, here's a fudge factor that we need to throw in there to make this this number more accurate. Mm-hmm. And but in this case, they're not inclined to correct their fudge factors to get the right answer.
Now, just quickly
because
here, because
of the underlying philosophy,
we're running out of time here. Not that we have a deadline here, but there's another idea I wanted to get to, and we had talked about carbon 14 dating some time ago, and the Institute for Creation Research had done some research on that, and you had talked in a previous program about pockets of some other element that were found, or gas, that indicates that is not accurate either.
Well,
I've forgotten.
We were talking about radioisotopic dating, just the general technique, not necessarily about carbon 14.
Okay, I got you.
The carbon. Well, anyway, there's a lot of roads we could go down, but the basic. The thing was, in granite, there are, for example, and I think this is what you might have been referring to, there's a certain crystalline rock that has uranium in it, and in granite. And so you can look at that, and the uranium, one of the degradation products of uranium is helium. And if the rock is extremely old, as would be dated by, you know, these techniques, then you shouldn't find any helium, in these crystals, zirconium crystals. But what the Institute of Creation Research said, well, you know, we don't believe these rocks are old, and so therefore we should find some helium. And indeed, they did the experiment and found helium. And when you look at that, and then when you look at try to make some assumptions about the diffusion of helium through through these zirconium crystals, you come up with age of the granite at less than 10,000 years. Well, that fits with the creation model, and it doesn't fit with the long age, model. And so the more we look, it seems, even in geology and, in biology and various in cosmology, I mean, the more we look, the more, points to a young universe and a young Earth and very complex, life, as we've talked about, that couldn't have happened, by chance. And the more all of these pieces of data point to, a creator, and in particular, how this universe was created as described in Genesis.
The Institute for Creation Research is dedicated to really demonstrating scientifically that the Earth is young, and that it was created by a supreme being. But I want to emphasize the word science here, because they know how to make an argument scientifically, and they're staffed with experts in various scientific disciplines. The article we're talking about is entitled "Monuments of Catastrophe from Mount St. Helens" by Brian Thomas. And it's available at the Institute of Creation Research website, which we will link to. We'll link to the article when we do our podcast here later this morning of our conversation with Don. But you can just search for this, too, at ICR.org. That's Institute for Creation Research, ICR.org. And search for monuments or Mount St. Helens, and this article will pop up quickly. It's a great website. Another great website you should know about is the Creation Moments website. That's creationmoments.com. And you can link to them right from our webpage, Broken Road Radio, and you'll discover a wealth of scientific articles and videos and explanations that indicate a young Earth creation. And I would urge you, especially if you're from the establishment way of thinking, that, well, it's got to be 4 billion, it's got at least billions of years. Take a look at this and do it dispassionately, do it rationally, and see what the other side of science has to say about this, because it is convincing. It's a persuasive case for a young Earth, and I think you'll find it informative. And this article, too, on Mount St. Helens. Don, how's the vineyard going? You got your harvest all done?
Well, yes, we do. We had one more field to pick, but we had some help with the local wildlife. The
pigs, little harvest for you.
Got that harvest, and so I was looking. We were out looking at the vines yesterday, and the pigs just eat the berries. They leave the stems behind, and so vines that had a large number of clusters were picked clean. So most disappointing, and we got to solve this pig problem obviously for the future.
I'm thinking smoked ham, prosciutto you could make. There's you could open a bacon stand at the side of the highway. A lot of answers to this problem. Don, and for those of you who don't know, also is a vigneron in Garden Valley, Texas. He's kind of helping to start. I want to call it a tourist industry, but a network of wine tasting places and businesses throughout that area, just east of Dallas. He and other companies starting to take a look at the Texas wine potential here, and it's kind of interesting to follow his exploits. Already won an award, didn't you, for your
Blanc de Vaux? Yes, entered one of our wines from 2013 harvest, and we got a gold medal for it. So quite pleased with that, and it was a shot in the arm for you know, an encouragement to say, hey, maybe we can make a go of this after all.
Yeah, not only that, but Don gets to practice biochemistry again. It takes a lot of that kind of work when you're doing wine stuff. Don, appreciate your time today and the information about Mount St. Helens. I want to recommend this article to folks. And again, our podcast will be up in a couple hours. You can take a look at it yourself. Don, have a great week. We'll see you next week.
Okay, very good. It was a pleasure being with you again, Jim.
Well, we'll see you on Tuesday. Bye-bye.
Bye.